Thank you. Today, I thought I'd try to think of a good topic that's optimization-related that I've worked on in the past, and I've kind of, chemical engineers get involved with optimization, and as we're into the problems, we kind of get intrigued by the numerical methods, and we have the job of making products that run reliably, so we inevitably get involved in tinkering with the mathematics, and I happen to get a little deeper than most and spend a lot of time in this area. So some of my favorite conferences are like the SIAM conference on optimization rather than any chemical engineering conferences. So mathematicians do a lot of good work. So this will be my topic for today. I'm going to talk about these things today. I'll tell you a little bit about Honeywell and their business and products related to optimization, and then something called model predictive control. That's what we call it in our engineering domain. For you, you can think of it as optimal control applied to a chemical process. We've just kind of evolved our own way of doing that problem. It involves linear and quadratic programming and nonlinear programming. And then I'll talk about nonlinear model predictive control. And I'll go over one of Honeywell's products that incorporates that and kind of give you an idea of the history of the development and show you some math of how the problem is formulated, talk about the technology, talk about issues we have when we try to implement this on a plant, and then some of our future challenges that are related to business things and mathematics. So, brief overview of Honeywell. In case you're not familiar with Honeywell, we have about 120,000 employees. We have four major divisions. I work in the automation and control solutions in the company Honeywell Process Solutions. But we also have Honeywell Transportation Systems. They make turbochargers for a lot of the trucks, diesel trucks that, if you own one, it probably has a Honeywell turbocharger. We have an aerospace division where they do aircraft systems and engines, flight management systems, software that, controls the flight, and critical components, avionics, all this kind of high-tech stuff, a lot of stuff in F-16s and whatnot, and specialty materials. We have some chemical plants that make some special types of chemicals, and we have UOP, which is Universal Oil Products. Probably 75% of the world's refineries use the UOP technology for refining, processing oil into gasoline and other products. So a lot of people just think we make thermostats, but it's really quite a diverse company. Getting a lot into security and things like that, too. We also have Honeywell Technology Solutions. These are some of our research labs. Honeywell Process Solutions and our groups, we're more product companies. Research is kind of a bad word, so we do development, but these divisions do more research. We have 446 locations in 100 countries. I was just at our Toronto office today, and tomorrow I'm going to our Montreal office, and we have one in Calgary, one in Vancouver, just about every city you can think of. $31 billion in sales, and our automation and control solution in 2009 had $13 billion in sales. In the company that I work in, Honeywell Process Solutions, we have what's called an advanced solutions business. These are basically software products that are applied mostly in industry, in chemical and petrochemical industries, for doing certain tasks, mostly control and optimization, other aspects. And we have different types of advanced solutions. There's the advanced process control and optimization. We have something called Profit Suite, which is a collection of products for basically improving the economics of the process while maintaining safety. There's some miscellaneous specialized control packages, including what I call model predictive control software. We have simulation business. Unisim Design is our computer plant simulation product. And then Unisem Operations is a project organization that does projects to develop operator training simulators for operators of chemical plants. Pilots may have, some like a flight simulator that they learn to fly by, and the space shuttle pilots train in one. And we have, we make simulators for chemical plants so that the operator can, we can schedule it to malfunction and they have to work their way out of that. It's a dynamic model. And so we have it's like a $50 million business doing that. And then we have manufacturing execution systems. I just listed a couple of here, but these guys over here know a lot about that. Bill Holly does some gasoline blending optimization applications where he's got specifications to meet for gasoline, octane number, and all that, and they're giving him different components to blend it, and they want to make it cheap, but meet the specifications. Jeff Kelly does the planning and scheduling, that's really a problem very similar to model predictive control, except a different time horizon. He looks at weeks and months ahead into the future and uses optimization to determine solution. We look hours into the future for these control problems that I'm going to talk about. And then we have control and safety systems. A good percentage of the chemical and petroleum refining plants around the world use Honeywell systems for their basic controls in the plants. So I didn't know where to start. If you've had calculus of variations or optimal control courses or something like that, that's what you can think of when we call model predictive control. It's a control algorithm that embeds a predictive model, something that can predict. And in our business, it's been highly successful, and we've gotten a long ways by using linear dynamic models. You can think of a linear differential equation, write it in discrete form, and that type of model for a multivariable system, multiple inputs, multiple outputs, we can design an application to control a chemical plant, and it works pretty well. It's considered advanced process control. So there's process control, which is your basic regulatory loops in the plant, that are just moving a valve to control a temperature, single input, single output. Advanced process control is when you're looking at a multivariable system and you have constraints and other things you have to consider, maybe economics. Normally, model predictive control sends its optimal solution or its set points to lower level controllers. It'll calculate an optimal solution and send that to another controller that's got to implement. But we can also send that solution directly to a valve and move it. In a chemical plant, if you want to change anything, you got to change a valve position. You got to open or close a valve, pretty much. You want to change the temperature, you want to change the pressure, you want to change the flow rate, whatever. So valves eventually got to move. Back in the early 80s, there were maybe 20 to 30 applications. Now, I just saw this guy's presentation. He did a review on model predictive control, Tom Badgewell, who works for Exxon. There's somewhere between 5 and 10,000 applications with estimated benefits of $1 to $2 billion a year. That means if these applications weren't there, collectively, the world would be making that less money. I mean, this is where optimization is really driving dollar benefits for the plant. It's doing things better than a human being can do it by itself because it's too complicated. So we compute the solution over time. It employs linear and quadratic programming, which I thought that might be interesting for you. You could have a separate calculation for economic optimization. And the main difference between linear model predictive control and nonlinear is simply you have a linear or a nonlinear model. This is kind of a graphical view of here. This line here represents the current time right now. This is the past, the history. So we know what moves we made. We implement the moves in the plant in a discrete fashion. We don't give an analog signal out to the plant that's a continuous form. We make a move and then there's a finite amount of it holds and we change it and it holds. And then your outputs are measured in some type of fashion. You know, we're saying it's continuous here, but it could be discrete. So you have a set point here you want to move to, and so you can calculate a set of future moves for your independent variables such that you drive this output to its set point. Now, if you want to think of that more generally, let's say we don't have a set point, but we have a set point high and a set point low. We have a range, a safety range we want to be in. Then we'd be computing moves to move it inside that range. Does that make sense? So what's the motivation for nonlinear model predictive control? Linear control was very successful. Why complicate things by adding a nonlinear model if we can do it well with a linear model? We can use linear programming. It's very reliable now. Well, as engineers started looking for new places to apply this technology, they eventually hit some areas where it didn't work very well. And it's quite simple to explain. For certain problems, such as in polymer process control problems, these are processes where you're making plastic polymers. These plastics have different properties, melt index and density, and there's a number of end-use properties that are required. They have to change the operating conditions in the chemical plant dramatically to change the properties a small amount. So, and the sensitivities, you know, you talk about gradients, the sensitivities of the outputs to the inputs change dramatically. So a linear model doesn't work. You don't have the constant sensitivity that you do in a refinery. If you're controlling some, you know, cut point on a crude column or something like that, and you're changing the steam, it's a pretty linear relationship. If you move it by 5 units, this changes by 10 units, pretty much. And so, but this is quite different. You got a quite different sensitivity. So there are some interesting problems here. Your regulatory performance, meaning what you do is you make a grade of polymer and then you want to change to a new grade. The change is called transition, and then you've got on-grade control where you're just trying to maintain your product properties. So everything changes dramatically, and also you need to minimize the loss during grade transitions. If you're, a lot of candy companies have this, you know, they're changing flavors or doing something. You know, the stuff in between is not really sellable. You know, if it's half vanilla and half chocolate, maybe you can sell it as off-grade ice cream. But plastic, you've got specs for it. You know, it needs to be between this and that. And you're moving to the new product, you're making a bunch of in-between product. You can sell it as off-grade material, which is cheaper. But you really like to minimize that. So basically, it comes down to linear dynamic models are inadequate. I mean, not everything in the world, you know, can be modeled as linear equations. Chemical engineers are very lucky. They got all this accomplished and all these benefits with linear models. But eventually, you meet problems where you have to model those nonlinearities. So that's basically, you know, we talked about that. I think I have an example here. These are step responses, and you know, I think it's in mathematics, you know, I think that's a well-defined step function. You go to the process, and for example, this is a change in 31 kilograms per hour of butene, a chemical. And this is the response of the melt index for three different products. For the first product, for a 31 kilogram change, you don't hardly see any effect at all. For the second product, you see a pretty good effect. And the third one, you see a very strong effect. Okay? That's just saying the sensitivity changes. When you go to a different operating point, things are different. The sensitivities are different. So if you're trying to control this melt index on this grade, you know, you don't have to move it very much. Where if you want to change it here, you got to move it a lot. The control problem needs to know that. It needs to reflect that sensitivity change. And these are some other dramatic examples for polymers where the sensitivities just vary quite a bit. So being engineers, we try to think of, okay, how can we solve this problem? I don't want to use nonlinear model predictive control. I want to just tweak my linear problem a little bit and maybe I can solve it. So there's been a variety of techniques throughout the 90s that people tried to address this problem. The first one is, well, I'll just detune my controller so that it won't go unstable when I go to the new point and you get poor performance. Well, that's kind of ridiculous. It doesn't work very well. Some people were very clever and they used transformation of variables in certain problems in controlling compositions of products on a high purity distillation column, for example. They found they could use a log transformation. The fundamentals underneath there have some kind of exponential behavior, so they found they could do a log transformation, and then that could be external. And so basically that was a way of linearizing their control problem. So there were some clever ways of that. The other thing to do is just, okay, I got 10 products. I'm going to store 10 different sensitivities, and when I change products, I'll use the appropriate sensitivity for that product. Well, the problem is when do you change the gain over? You're going from product A to product B. You kind of blend them in, or do you change it? So there's problems with that. What if I want a new grade? I want an 11th grade. Then I've got to get another sensitivity. So there was maintenance issues with that. Then they decided, okay, well, let's take a nonlinear model and linearize it, and we'll just update the controller at each cycle with new sensitivity information based on a nonlinear model offline. And that worked fairly well. You got better regulatory performance, but you got poor transition performance. That's the performance when you're moving to the next grade, because when you're moving from one grade to the next in the control problem, you're looking at all of your future moves, and your future moves don't reflect the sensitivity change into the future in your optimization problem. The optimization problem thinks that the sensitivity is constant across the time horizon into the future that you're looking. And so it computes a lot of aggressive moves or a lot of moves that aren't very big enough. And then as you move along by feedback, you find out you didn't do enough and you don't get good performance. And so they've tried, this is kind of another variation of that, where you try to do the dynamic optimization online and use linear control. You still don't get that quality of being able to, of reflecting the nonlinearity over your predictions so that you know when you get to grade B, you don't have to make very big moves. But as you're approaching it, you've got that sensitivity information. And then you look at real nonlinear control, you can use empirical models or rigorous models. And we'll talk a bit about that. And there's different ways to do the dynamic modeling, of course. Empirical black box models, these would be, I don't know what you would call them, ARMA models or nonlinear ARMA models, time series models where you're trying to estimate terms. What else? Hammerstein combined with Wiener Hammerstein type models, some type of empirical model with no real physical structure, mathematical structure, parameters to be estimated that could be used. Nice thing about it is you don't need to put any engineering knowledge into it. You can just estimate it. I think neural nets would probably fall into that category. Neural network models, you familiar with that? Okay, empirical gray box. Again, this is our terminology. Black box means you really don't know what's going on inside. Gray box means you kind of know what's going on inside from a fundamentals point of view. So these models are kind of a hybrid. You take kind of a general structure and you take some of the physics that you might know as an engineer. Like, I know the relationship between this property and that operating condition is a power law, for example. You know, it's fundamentally that. So you can embed that in the model. So you put a little bit of engineering knowledge in there. And then you have first principles models. This is the type of model that we saw on the last slide where you're actually doing the mass and energy balances and You've got the full rigor there. And you're always going to have a little bit of empirical components, even in a rigorous model. But these are the different approaches. This kind of goes back to showing you the landscape of where we are, where we've come with model predictive control. And you can see back in the 80s, you know, there were a few products, and Shell was involved with some of them, and Invensys, and there were some other companies. And this is basically, I think in other industries they have their own products, in aerospace, I don't know what they do. But this is the chemical and petroleum industry. These are the main products. Honeywell has had different things that have evolved through different generations. We, you know, have a profit controller now, which is RMPCT. And then we have some Nova software. The company I used to work for was eventually acquired by Honeywell, but we did a lot of optimization work in the 90s. And then this product called NLC came about in the 90s. We'll talk more about that in a minute. There's a product called Process Perfector. That product uses neural net models. It's nonlinear. And then a product called Apollo by AspenTech. It also uses neural net models. And then NLC became Profit NLC, and then that's being merged now into something called Profit Controller with nonlinear extensions. So that this is just kind of a vendor viewpoint, show you all the little products and how they evolve through the years and where we are now in the world of model predictive control. So now I'm going to talk about Honeywell's model, nonlinear model predictive control product, Profit NLC. It's a product for nonlinear optimal control applications. It's in the Profit Suite group. It was developed in conjunction with ExxonMobil Chemical's Advanced Process Control Group. Basically, they were users of Nova software, which was ours. It's an optimization package, and they wired together a prototype to meet their own needs for their control problems, and then came to us later and said, hey, can you make a product out of this and sell it back to us, because it works pretty well. And so we worked with them on developing, you know, the technology and the software side of it. And then, you know, there's a patent on it that was done in 1997 by Bartusiak and Fondane. And then myself and Joseph Liu, one of the chief scientists at Honeywell, did another patent on a different formulation of the control problem that's more related to the Honeywell Profit Controller. So basically, Exxon has kind of a version of it. And basically what it is how you define the error for the objective function. There's two different strategies for that. This application embeds a nonlinear dynamic model. We basically use a nonlinear continuous state space form. So you can think of like a differential equation model of a tank or a vessel or a reactor. You write it out fundamentally and that. It also has the ability to handle multiple objectives for prioritized control and economic optimization. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. It has an equation-based solution of dynamic models, which I'll talk about that. I don't know, you know, how much you're these are our own terminologies, but basically, if you have a differential equation model and you discretize it into a representative set of algebraic equations, and then you just slap that in as the constraints in a nonlinear programming problem directly, that's what we do. Some people call it direct transcription. I don't know what other parts of the math community call it, but it's an alternative strategy to iterating between the optimizer and then another model. That the optimizer, you know, the optimizer is perturbing the model. We're just putting all the equations there for the optimizer. That's a key enabler for us to do this. We could not do it, I don't think, any other way. Before I get to the math, I'll just show you a little bit about the graphical representation of some of the things. Basically, these dashed lines represent an area inside. You want to be inside that area. Like, it's an upper limit and a lower limit. over a time horizon into the future. So we kind of have this inverse funnel shape kind of thing. Inside here, there's no penalty. If you're outside of here, you're penalized. Okay? You can see here, if you start moving outside of this thing, even if you're not above that limit, you incur a penalty because this constraint imposes a bound on the rate of change of a variable. So if it sees a variable starting to move up fast, it'll take control action to anticipate that, to turn it back to be inside this feasible region. Okay? This is another look when you're coming from outside of the feasible region. This is the feasible region, and you're coming from, let's say, from one point to the next. You have this area. If you're inside this area, but you're below the region, the feasible region, the controller won't make any moves because it knows it's on a trajectory to go into the feasible region. So these are some of the interesting aspects. And these are some other control products. I think we'll just skip some of this. Now, Honeywell's product, and we also have this kind of form. This is an inverse funnel. And this says there's really no penalty in the near term for what you want to do, but down the road, I want you to be inside these limits. And so within this, there's many, many solutions. Since it's such a wide feasible region, there's many, many solutions. So what we do is we formulate, we have some similar terms to what we saw before. It's kind of like a regularization term. It's a minimum movement term. It says, I want to get there, but I want to make as few moves as possible. So that's a highly desirable solution in the chemical industry. If you go there with a lot of optimal solutions that do crazy things, they'll turn it off and say, I don't know what it's doing. But if it makes some very nice, smooth step changes, it's very easy to explain, then they'll accept it. This is kind of a demo of showing how the funnel closes up and clamps it to a set point. As you're seeing this close up, it's like moving forward in time. That's kind of what the funnel does. The other thing we do, which is what I mentioned, it's a key thing about this product, is simultaneous optimization and control. I mean, for you guys, it might be a no-brainer, but in the chemical industry, we do a lot of control and there's no economics involved. Think about linear programming. In your linear programming course, you have phase one and phase two. You're familiar with those terms? Getting the feasibility phase and then the optimality phase, whatever. That's kind of what we have. Control means we want to be feasible. We want to get feasible. We don't care about economics. And then economic optimization means, okay, now I'm feasible. Where do I need to be to minimize my energy usage, my fuel gas consumption? I want to stay inside my limit. So we do this simultaneously in this application. So, but it's done by a multi-level objective function, which we'll talk about. And that's where the term nonlinear model predictive optimal control, because some people just talk about nonlinear model predictive control. They're really just doing control, not doing any economics combined with that. So that Jeff and I are big on acronyms. We like to come up with an acronym for everything. So, all right. So here is the Profit NLC problem statement. This is a basically like a in this form, it's like a calculus of variations problem, I guess you would say. It's optimization of functionals. So, your solution is a function, just like his solution was a trajectory. Our solution is a trajectory. The only difference is our optimal solution here, we know we're going to implement it on a computer. So we specify, instead of some arbitrary function into the future, which is our optimal solution, we specify that it's got to be a set of discrete moves into the future. So, for example, if we're running this controller once every 2 minutes, then the controller is going to think that something is changing and stays constant over each 2 minute interval into the future. So it can make a series of moves, but it doesn't have infinite flexibility to do all these admissible curves that you could possibly think of. It has to be of this form. Okay? So we'll go over some of these terms so you can understand this. This is a lot like his objective function. This is basically a composite objective function where you've got the control error, you've got your economics, and then you've got a regularization term which says, if I have any degrees of freedom left over, I'd like to just minimize movement. And so this right here is your model. Really, this combined too. I don't know if this is, a lot of times people write dx dt is equal to something. Well, I like to write it implicit form. I don't know if you've ever done, chemical engineers do a lot of modeling, and when you write a dynamic model, they don't come out in that nice little neat form with the derivative all isolated on one side. You got to do a lot of algebra to, I don't want to have the modeling guy to have to do a lot of algebra. So I said, well, this is just an implicit function. But you can think about it as just a ordinary differential equation. And this is, I do this term here. This basically is a mapping from the states to the outputs. A lot of people like the state space terminology and jargon. So for those of you who like that, there it is. So this is your model of the process. If you have a polymer plant, these are the things you manipulate, and these are the things you're trying to control. These are some other things we'll define in a minute. Now, I need to define my error, okay? This objective function is very general. It just says I want to minimize the weighted integral of the error. We'll look at that. So how do you define your error? Well, depending on how you define your error, you can get different control behaviors. So I have a couple of differential equations here that define the error. See, I've got my limits, set point high and set point low. I'm basically making a soft constraint. We call them soft constraints. It's a limit that can be violated, but once it's violated, it's penalized. And then I have some tuning factors, this tau and C, that the control engineer can use to say how fast you want to get to where you want to be. You want to take all day? Okay, fine, I'll make tiny moves. You want to get there now? Okay, we're going to hit it as hard as we can. We're going to make big moves. And then this equation here is feedback. What that means is I'm measuring. If you leave this out, then all this control problem is, it's called an open loop optimal control problem. It's controlling the model's predictions. Okay? You got a model, it'll control those predictions. But if your model doesn't match your process, doesn't do much good. So you got to do something to your model to calibrate it along the way so that you make sure it's matching your model. So the first thing you do is you model as good as you can. Hopefully I captured everything I can where I get pretty decent predictions, and then I'm going to use feedback. Now all this says is I'm taking in a measured value of these Y variables that I'm controlling, these outputs. I got an error term and maybe another tuning factor. And then I got this V term, which I call an estimated disturbance. And you see V is in the model up here? So I can adjust V in the model to make it this Y mesh match this Y model. Does that make sense? And there's many ways I can do that. And we'll go over some of those. And then I have... Okay, we have constraints on the output. These are hard constraints. We normally don't use hard constraints. You know what I mean by hard and soft constraints? Hard constraint means you cannot violate it. It's going to declare infeasible if it has to. The code will say, this is not a feasible problem. Soft constraint means you got a violation, but it's still feasible, but you like to get rid of it if you can. These are hard constraints. You only use those on outputs on things that are like a tank. You can't go below zero on a tank, and you can't overflow it. You can't relax that. They won't allow you to relax that. So those are an example of hard output constraints. These are valve positions. They get to be between whatever, 5% and 95%, 0 and 100. You can never violate these. When they give you they say you can move this between 5 and 10. You just can't violate it. You can't relax it. And likewise, they'll also tell you for each control cycle, you can never move this more than five, you can't move it more than 2 degrees every 2 minutes. Sorry. That's it. So that's a delta, means it can't change, it's a rate of change limit. You can think of it as a constraint on the rate of change of you in discrete form. And then, of course, these are basically like slack variables. They define the error from here. Does that all make sense? It's kind of a complicated problem, but as you've seen, if you had calculus of variations or things like that, it's kind of a practical formulation of that problem. I got a few more slides to tell you about. I think we already know these are the manipulated variables. This is our true independent variables. These are our decision variables. And remember, it has that step response. It's constrained to be a step response. It can't be any functional. These are our states in the model, time derivative of the state. D is a disturbance variable. These are things that we can measure, but we can't manipulate. And they're not outputs. They're like, for example, to a chemical plant, maybe we can measure the feed temperature, but we can't change it. And it's pretty much constant. So that's going to affect my model predictions. So I want to include that in the model. And then V is the estimated disturbance variable. There may be some things in my model that I don't know. Like for a heat exchanger where you're trying to heat up a fluid, there's something called a heat transfer coefficient. It has a value, but it may change over time if it gets fouled or, you know, gets a lot of deposits on it. So that's something I might need to estimate. And I can do it I can measure a temperature and I can kind of back calculate what that needs to be. So that's my model. This is the objective function broken down into three terms. This first term is if you look at it, it's an integral from the current time to the final time. We're looking over a prediction horizon. And this is a weight for the set point high and a weight for the set point low. They can be different. And this is the error for the set point high and the error for the set point low. Omega is simply a function. It's a weighting function. It says, how do I want to weight this over time? I could weight it different ways. I could say, ooh, right now is real important, and in the future is not so important. Or I can do it in reverse. I can say, I want to increase my weight. Or I want to weight it infinitely at certain points. So that's not real important. What we end up doing is we say, we really want to use a direct delta function so that we make, so every 2 minutes, whenever we get a measurement, that's where we want to evaluate that integral. We want it to be infinitely important at the points we can measure. So this is basically, in a nutshell, this is a single value, a scalar value. We took this integral, it's an integral average weighted violation of the control variable. We want them to be between low and high in the future, and this is a measure of how much they violate, weighted perhaps by a control engineer in some way. Some things are more important than others. This is the economic term. This is just like a linear programming objective function. Without loss of generality, I can make this a linear objective function. If you got a nonlinear term, g of x, give it to me. I'm going to make I'll make a variable z is equal to g of x. Now I'm going to put a cost on z. So I got a linear objective function. Doesn't matter. So this is an integral average profit, let's say, or cost. That makes sense? Cost term for the outputs, for the inputs, for the disturbance variables, divide by the time span, gives an average. And then this one is a penalty, which I'll define. It basically is like a penalty on the rate of, another penalty on the rate of change of the control variables. It basically means I don't want to, if I'm not going to make much money, I don't really want to move the plant. I don't want to move a valve open and close, open and close, open and close for $1 Canadian a month in my objective function. That's just ridiculous. So you want to put some cost on moving. And when I evaluate those integrals, or if I put a direct delta function in there, I can convert them to a discrete form, which converts it into a sum. Okay? And then this term here is just a sum of the absolute values of the moves into the future. Now, since we use continuous optimization method, we have to get rid of that absolute value, and there's well-known tricks to do that. That make sense? That's the objective function. Control error, economics, and if I have any desire to penalize movement, I can do that some. And really, if you look at this, it's really a multi-level optimization problem, or a hierarchical, that's how you say it, optimization problem. In other words, you've got a sequence of problems you want to solve, really. I mean, in a chemical plant, let's say a constraint I have, an upper limit, is the most important thing of anything. It's more important than economics. If I exceed that constraint, the plant blows up. Okay? I'm going to call that my priority one constraint. And there are constraints like that. Okay? Now, another thing, my production rate. Okay, how important is that? Is that important relative to my product properties? No. I'd rather be on spec on my properties and make less or more. So I'm going to make my product properties priority two, for example. Am I making sense? So an engineer sits there and prioritizes them. And then we resolve those in order. If the controller can get them all, great. If he can do them all. If it can't, then it minimizes priority one error. And then the error, let's say it got it down to 2 units of error. It's going to constrain that error to be less than or equal to 2 units, go on to the next optimization problem. So it solves a sequence of problems, and then it gets it. Then after all the safety is resolved, we can start making money. We can go on to the economic problem. Now, this... And when we looked at the objective function, we really didn't talk about how is the error defined. Well, if you come up with your own way to define error, you can have your own control algorithm. That's part of the design of the controller, is figuring out what's a good way to pose the error. Do I want to eliminate the error right away, like in the next 2 minutes? Well, if these chemical plants have huge reactors, they're filled with tons of stuff. So you can't change the properties in them very fast. So it's kind of ridiculous to say, okay, I'm off spec. I want to instantaneously be on spec. This can't happen. There's too much inertia in the system. It's, you know what I'm saying? It's got its own dynamics, its own natural dynamics. So it's better to give some consideration to those natural dynamics when you're designing the controller to say, okay, We're gonna say I want you to eliminate that error, but I'm gonna have a tunable time constant to say how we get there. But you could say instantaneously, and what it'll do, it'll just slam every variable to its limits, and it won't be a very practical solution to implement. So set tau to zero, and that's the solution you get. It's like, I want to be there instantly. And then the C term is the second order term, if you want to add a little bit of second order behavior there. And this is one example of the second order reference trajectory. So basically, it specifies, if you look at the steady state of it, it really, if the steady state of this differential equation is, you're going to be between the limits. That's good. But the dynamic part of it tells how fast you get there. So that's what makes it nice to tune. Now here's kind of an example of the two different, the behavior of it. This bottom graph shows a control move, a U, that's made. You know what I mean by like a first order ODE? Let's take dx dt is equal to AX plus BU. One input, one output. That's a very trivial I think it's the simplest linear differential equation you can think of. One input, one output. That's what this model is, and it's very simple to show you the limiting behavior of the controller. The reference trajectory formulation that I just showed, those equations on the last slide, gives this behavior, RT. These are the control moves. It overshoots and then comes back down to a steady state value. And then this light blue line is the response. Now, performance ratio is a tuning factor we have, and all we do is we scale the time constant for the controller by the natural process time constant, or a nominal value that the process responds in. So let's say it takes 2 hours. You make a step change, and the time constant for that is 2 hours. And if you require it to respond in 2 hours, that'd be a performance ratio of 1. If you have a performance ratio of 0.5, that means I want you to respond twice as fast as your natural response time to a step change. Does that make sense? So if you make a step change, it responds in 1 hour. You say, I want it to respond in a half an hour. So that's what a performance ratio of 0.5 means. So in order to do that, if the performance ratio was 1, it would just make a step change and stop. I said, fine, I got it. And this would go. But since we required it to be faster than normal, it overshoots and comes back down. Now, the RCA formulation, that's a different error model. Remember, I told you we have a couple different error models, and depending on the control engineers, they may use one or the other option. This one has more of a funnel shape that collapses, and so you can see it gets there faster, but it makes fewer moves. It makes a move and holds it longer and then comes back down to the same steady state. So that's two different, shows you the effect of changing the way you define error. Two different ways, same model, same everything, same objective function, except the error definition is different. So kind of gives you some limiting case behavior. What does the controller do? How does it perform? Well, if it can, it'll make some small moves to get there. And then we'll talk a little bit about feedback. I'm just got like one slide on that. That's a whole nother presentation. But if you think of it, the simplest approach, engineers are really hackers. I mean, they got away with murder for years on feedback. You know, what's the simplest way you can think to make a model match the plant? Just add a bias, add an offset. Say, okay, my model's predicting 5, the plant measurement is 6, I'm going to add a linear offset variable that's going to be equal to 1, so it'll make my model prediction equal to the plant prediction. Literally, that's what was used quite a bit during the 80s. Now, taking the next step further, you say, I don't want to instantly match it because that might cause some instability. You know, feedback, anytime you have a feedback, you got to worry about stability. Oscillations growing and big problems. So if you want to stabilize it, you can put a filter on it. You can filter the value. Actually, you could filter the measurement if you wanted to, but if you're bringing in an unfiltered measurement, you can apply a filter to the bias. You can calculate the error. You can calculate what the bias should be, and you can say, okay, 0.1 times this current value plus 0.9 times the last value, and you can kind of bring it in over time to match. That's what I mean by a filtered bias. That's pretty simple, and it works in a lot of cases. These other areas are a little more complicated, but in a nutshell, this one is similar, except it allows you, like the heat transfer coefficient example I gave, let's say you can measure the temperature and you can back calculate in your model the heat transfer coefficient. Well, I don't want to do that instantly. I want to do it dynamically. I want to make that heat transfer coefficient change its value over time to match the measured value. That's what this implicit dynamic feedback is. It's kind of a nonlinear version of this, but it's basically kind of an extension of the same thing. And then state estimation is a more rigorous optimization way of doing it. Are you guys know what state estimation is? Common filtering? Okay. The problem with common filtering, and there's different ways of doing it, you know, for nonlinear problems, you have to do extended common filtering. What if I have constraints? I don't want to let it estimate a heat transfer coefficient that's negative. I don't want to have compositions that are negative, so I want to put constraints on it. Well, the common filtering approach just doesn't, you know, it's not naturally suited for that. There's a lot of other things. It doesn't, if you have algebraic equations, for example, in your model, you got to eliminate them. I don't want to do that. I want to preserve my natural model. So we looked at other approaches based on, in our area, it's called moving horizon estimation. I don't know if you have anything, what the mathematicians call it. I mean, I don't think we invented it. We, you know, Pontryagin or whatever did optimal control many, you know, I don't know when, you know, and there's stuff way before us, but we do something in our own domain and they give it a name, and the chemical engineering profs that work on this call it moving horizon estimation. It's basically just like a model predictive control problem, except you have a history of measurements. You're not using one measurement, you're using a history of measurements to calibrate your model to the current state of the plant. And it just has a lot of nice features. I think I'm going to have to accelerate here. That I won't go into, but it handles constraints better and so forth. I'm going to have to whiz through some of this stuff because I talk too much. This is kind of the architecture of the system. You have a process model, control model, your objective function. This DAE system basically does the discretization for us. We solve it using our own optimization technology, something called NOVA, which stands for Nonlinear Optimization for Versatile Applications. So this is like a standard general nonlinear programming problem. When we get through with everything, it fits into this form. We discretize. Ultimately, it's solved by this package. Talked about NOVA. It's flow sheeting, which means we can connect multiple models together. Our solver technology uses sequential quadratic programming. We call it generalized because it's able to solve for infeasible stationary points, meaning if you pose a problem that's infeasible, it has very good convergence behavior. It'll kind of go into that mode and resolve the infeasibilities that way. It's been used in a lot of online applications, so we've put a lot of stability into it. Handles nonlinear complementarity problems, which is another thing, and it's used as a solver for a number of advanced solution products. The DAE system, I talked about that earlier, direct transcription method. It uses orthogonal collocation on finite elements. Basically makes a giant set of algebraic equations. It doesn't have error control, but we over-discretize to make sure that, and test our schemes out to make sure they work. And it works well. So only got a few more minutes. Computation time. We can solve these problems in 2 to 5 minutes. Hot starts are important. You know, as we're solving along in time, for example, if we solve every 2 minutes, the problem we're solving 2 minutes from now is very similar to the problem we're solving right now normally. These plants don't move. Sometimes they're just completely still, not moving. So we solve a lot of problems that don't take much computing effort. And you have to take advantage of, you know, previous active set and things like that, which is why interior point methods haven't worked out well for us until somebody can come up with a great warm start method and handle degeneracy. We won't be able to take advantage of that. I gave an example here. Running two-minute cycle means about 262,800 NLP problems solved every year. In order to have robustness, we have a lot of anti-cycling strategies. We have to handle local infeasibilities, meaning if the linearization of the problem is poor, but we have lots and lots of constraints on our profiles, it could be locally infeasible, but we still need a good search direction. You got to be able to go through that into some kind of good descent direction and keep going. It's virtually crash proof, which means you can basically put garbage in and it'll come back. It may come back with garbage, but it won't crash, like give us trace back or whatever. These applications can tolerate a couple of failures per month. We also have to use a lot of engineering knowledge to bound things. You know, the operation domain is known. I don't want negative compositions. I don't want negative flows. My temperatures, usually I know they're going to be between 100 C and 300 C, so I don't let it go outside that range. So that helps us deal with some of the non-convexity issues that you might have with a nonlinear model. And we do some iteration step bounding for really tough models. We may limit how much it can change on a per iteration basis. Reliability. Important points here. The decision variables are all bound. We don't have to worry about unbounded solutions because our domain is, like I said, compact. I think that's what we say. We have a compact domain. You can't get out of it. It's well defined. Extensive input and output validation. Since this is running on a plant and is going to be, without any human intervention, going to be sending an optimal solution out, you have to have extensive input and output validation. And so you can do a lot of script. These can be very sophisticated. You can do, for example, if your cooling water, you got a reactor and your cooling water valve is that it's wide open, means you can't cool it anymore. You don't want the controller to increase catalyst because, now it should know that. If you had a great model, it should know that it's not going to be able to get it in control because it's out of cooling capacity. But we don't trust the model. We put scripting in there that says, if the cooling water valve is at 100%, clamp the upper limit on the catalyst. So these things are extensive input validation and output. On the output side, we make sure that things make sense and so forth. We do get failures occasionally. Maximum iterations is a great one. But we have a feasibility mode. We can get feasible. We'll give it a maximum iterations of 10. If it can't solve it in 10 iterations, it gets feasible quickly and can implement a feasible suboptimal solution. And if it's infeasible, usually we've screwed up something. We missed something in the validation logic, or some limit that I said is a model validity limit is active. Like, remember I said the temperature can't be greater than 300 C? Well, if that's active and it's causing it to be infeasible, I want the controller to fail because something is wrong. Got time for a couple minutes for a quick application. I've been talking a little bit about this application, but this is a polymerization reactor. You put in like ethylene and some comonomer like butene, and you're making plastic polymers. The gas goes out here, recompressed, you cool it, and recycles, joins with the fresh feed. The polymer comes out the bottom here. They degas it so any vapors come off and go back and recycle. But this is pretty much polymer here. And so this is a reactor. We can inject catalyst or co-catalyst. So these are the things that we can manipulate. We can control some of these things. We can control flow rates here. We can control a valve position here. And we're trying to control the rate of production here and our product properties. So I told you before, I think I can skip this, but this shows variation, transition to a new product, and then variation. And what we want is little variation, quicker transition, and little variation at each product. So this particular controller had 15 control variables, 9 manipulated variables, so forth, and ran at a cycle. This is actual application. To give you an example of the discretized problem, it had 90,792 variables, this many equations, 318 degrees of freedom, 411,000 non-zeros, solves in about 10 to 30 seconds on a 2 gigahertz machine. That's the full dynamic optimization problem that fast. That's pretty good. And this is an example of the performance. Here, this is a real application. This is data from the Sasol plant in South Africa. These are the limits. You can see they change the limits in light blue for a new product. And they actually schedule them to overshoot a little bit and come down. And then the other limits, the purple limits, are the final product specs. So you can see this tracks along. And this step move here, these are actually lab values of the polymer that come in every 2 or 3 hours. So you can see the model predictions are pretty close. And when they come in, we'll recalibrate them. So that the model's doing a good job of predicting and gets it on spec. This is the instantaneous value of the property, and this is what's coming out of the reactor. So at any given instant, we're making a certain property, but there's a ton of it in the reactor, and this is what's finally coming out. And this is a control variable, and it goes down and overshoots its target a little bit and comes back in. So what are the benefits? Well, they did a six-month evaluation. There was a 29% reduction in transition time, 60% reduction in off-spec material. They had confidence to increase production rate by 260%, which means when you change production rate, you have to worry about how to counterbalance that with property changes. And so they can change rates really fast, and that's good. Challenges, I think I'm about done. What are the challenges? Well, these kind of nonlinear applications only represent less than 1% of all of the model predictive control applications. They're more complicated, and we need some low-cost advanced solutions. I mean, when you go to buy a car, not all of you want to buy a Cadillac or a Lexus. Some of you want to, that's not where I want to spend my money. I want to buy something reasonable that gets me from point A to point B. Well, that's where they view these control products. They say, I don't need all this extra stuff. I want some basic thing, but, you know, we're having to deal with that cost pressures to get our costs down. So, you know, in emerging markets and so forth, these are our business challenges. Maintenance. What if you have to change the model, reconfigure the model? There's not a lot of skill. So we need easier ways to do the modeling. When you go to a new process, anything in empirical modeling, I know McMaster's has done a lot of work on that, and that will help. And life cycle modeling is how to use the models in different domains, some challenges. We're always looking for help with optimization. Our method will break down if you take a lot of future moves, then we'll start to grind. And that's where interior point methods would be great, if they could handle hot starts and so forth. And we're going to be solving mixed integer problems in the near future to kind of extend that. So my last slide, path forward, we need to simplify. It's a great technology, but we need to keep the performance gains we've made, but tweak the approach to make it more maintainable, more understandable, and simpler. Standard, you know, we're going to be moving more towards moving horizon estimation and improve the optimization technology. So I think that's it. Thank you for your attention. Sorry, I went 3 minutes over.